coming to you this week with a special short. We'll call it a bonus episode of Conduct Detrimental. I am Dan Lust. I'm joined by Mike Lawson and Jason Morin. What's up, guys?
How much, Dan?
What's
How's
up,
it
Dan?
Going?
What's up, Jason?
Happy to be here for this short special episode.
We had a big week in Conduct Detrimental. We had our most downloaded podcast ever in the history of the show. A little bit behind the scenes. When we put articles on the site, as we've talked about on the podcast, Jason is the guy behind the scenes. If you get an email from Condetrimental at Gmail, it's either Jason or Stephanie, one of the two. Those guys kind of screen the articles coming in, then we have a conversation with when they should go up, if they should be changed. But Jason and Stephanie are really at the heart of it. I get a text from Jason. This is a true story. At about 1 a.m. on a Saturday morning, it was, you know, it was Friday midnight, goes to 1 a.m. And he says, I think I found something on a Mark Hunt lawsuit with UFC. I think it's ready to go up on the site. So we spoke about it. Story ends up going up on the site at 1 a.m., right around 1 a.m., 1:30. I don't really think anything of it. I'm up at baby o'clock. I'm up at 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, you know, whatever. I think about this lawsuit, whatever. I wake up at, you know, whatever time I woke up, 8, 9, or whatever, 7. The story has blown the F up. It is now, we won't speak specific numbers. I'll say this, if anyone could believe this, it has blown the Guardian stuff out of the water. It has blown the Barstool stuff out of the water. It is above and beyond the number one article on our website. It's past the Omar Vizquel stuff, which Jason was responsible for. So, you know, naturally, we have the top podcast that we've ever had on Conduct Detrimental. And now we have the top article ever on Conduct Detrimental. So only fitting we had Jason on the podcast to talk about it. But Jason, before we give it to you, our lovely guest, I know you're all ready to talk. Mike, is this episode sponsored by anybody in particular?
It is, actually. You know what? I don't know if we've ever mentioned this on the podcast, but this podcast is sponsored by Themis Bar Review, the best bar review out there. For all law students listening, it's coming time now where there's going to be tables at your law school. Give Themis a look. Talk to the reps there. They're absolutely excellent. And we have our own link if you want to check out. So go to themisbar.com/condetrimental. You can see what they're all about, their pricing, what they can offer you. If you're a 1L, a 2L, they have outlines. If you're a 3L, the bar prep. This podcast sponsored by Themis.
Mike, excellent, excellent job. Themis, they gave us the heads up. They're loving our partnership so much, they gave us our own page on their website. We talk about Themis a lot. Obviously, check out their stuff over there. So we haven't done one of these, Mike, since the Trevor Bauer we did back-to-back podcasts. But, you know, we got to bring it back. We got to ride the momentum here. So, Jason, listen, we're going to give you the floor. I want you to talk at a really high level about the lawsuit. I know Mike has some specific questions about the case. Tell us, you know, your high-level thoughts on this and your new best friend, Mark Hunt, who is posting on Instagram about you. It's pretty exciting.
Yeah, he's had some definitely colorful posts, we can say, in the last few days.
How about this for our listeners? Who is Mark Hunt?
Story time here. One of my best friends, I'll shout him out, Jake Mango, one of the biggest UFC fans I've ever met. If we rewind to my high school years, he used to force us to watch UFC before I actually became interested. And one night I'm watching the fights and there's this big lefty. I'm a lefty myself. There's this big, enormous lefty who's just throwing bombs at some guy. And I'm like, yeah, that's my favorite fighter right there. And that's Mark Hunt. And he's stayed in my top three favorite fighters ever since. Now we're here where I'm reporting about a lawsuit that he's involved in and where I think that he was wronged by some parties here and where I think he's in the right. So let's rewind to 2016 for some background on how we got here. In 2016, we have UFC 200, which is a really high level card. It's a card that was promoted for a long time. Originally was supposed to be Cormier Jones. And that card had eventually the light heavyweight division, Daniel Cormier versus Anderson Silva. The heavyweight co-main was Brock Lesnar versus Mark Hunt. And the women bantamweight main event was Miesha Tate versus Amanda Nunes. The fight that brought us to the courtroom was the heavyweight co-main, which is Brock Lesnar versus Mark Hunt. Dan, WWE wrestling fan.
Yeah.
Why are we talking about Brock Lesnar in the UFC?
You're actually saying Brock Lesnar wrong. It's actually Brock Lesnar. But go ahead.
Got it. Well, can we get a little bit of background in his WWE life?
Oh, my God. Of course. Oh, those close friends of mine will know that the great Paul Heyman, this is not a shtick. Paul Heyman and I connected on social media maybe 3 years ago. I consider Paul a mentor, a friend now at this point.
Friend of the podcast, Paul Heyman.
He did promise me, this is maybe a teaser if he actually follows through. He did promise me he would come on for our 200th episode of the podcast. We're getting close. I tried to get him for 150, wow, but he said that wasn't big enough. So maybe we'll get him. He's from Westchester too. So, you know, we kind of live fairly close. For those that don't know him, Brock Lesnar was a wrestling champion at the NCAA level and then went to WWE, kind of, you know, took the world by storm at post-Attitude Era, kind of in that John Cena era of like 2005, 2006, all Brock Lesnar. And then he just didn't think wrestling was a challenge anymore. He goes over to the Minnesota Vikings in the NFL, you know, tries out for the team in preseason. Doesn't really make the team. He's kind of floating around. He's like, you know what? I was a Division I undefeated championship wrestler. I'm super, super athletic. I'm an absolute freak. I think it's time for me to compete in some MMA here and test my skills here. So Brock has the pedigree. Being a Division I wrestling champion, I don't know if that makes you kind of a worldwide superstar, but being WWE champion at a very young age certainly does. So he took that pedigree, that superstardom in wrestling, sports and entertainment, which is what they call for wrestling nowadays. And he took it over to the Octagon. And I think he surprised a lot of people about how successful he was. But yeah, Brock Lesnar was the biggest name in all of USC. And obviously, you know, the biggest name in wrestling at the time. He since went back to wrestling. You know, he hung around UFC for a while, but he's on his way back to wrestling at this point in his career.
Yeah. Well, I can set that up because Brock actually retired from the UFC in 2011, and he did a stint back with the WWE. He went from the UFC in 2011 to the WWE. And then 2016 was when Brock Lesnar came back. And if I am correct, this was the first fight that Brock Lesnar had back in the Octagon since WWE, since that little retirement stint. And he was trying to make waves as the heavyweight contender, who at the time, Mark Hunt was a heavyweight contender, the Super Samoan, Mark Hunt. I actually remember this fight. What's interesting about this fight, and Jason, I'll kick it to you in a second, but it wasn't like a very crazy fight. It was kind of anticlimactic. It went the distance. It was a unanimous decision where Brock Lesnar did win over Mark Hunt. Again, it wasn't necessarily a surprise that he won. Brock Lesnar was a beast of his own, but this was, you know, Mark Hunt was on the rise for this heavyweight contender, and it's what comes after. And we find out quite soon after that one of the samples that Brock Lesnar had, and USADA at the time was very newly signed with UFC to do a doping policy with them. And it was 11 days prior that they took this sample. They didn't get an expedited report. And it comes out that Brock Lesnar tested positive for the banned substance clomiphene. And that's where this lawsuit sparked. So, Jason, tell us about the original lawsuit that starts and then what happens in the United States District Court in Nevada. And then we'll go from there.
Yeah, absolutely. And great background there. Just a couple relevant comments that were made leading up to the fight. One of which being Mark Hunt repeatedly said that he strongly believed that Lesnar was juicing or taking some kind of performance enhancing drug, you know, which is a relevant comment. And I will bring back later. But it just speaks to kind of the mens rea of the victim here. And we'll get more into that. Another really relevant comment is that UFC president Dana White, who we've discussed here before, he said that Brock Lesnar will be, quote, the most tested fighter on the card. Not sure if he came through on that promise, but anyway, after the fight is ruled a no contest.
I think he meant the most like battle tested. I think that's what he meant.
Right. He may argue that in a deposition if asked. You can't prove the exact meaning of that word, which, you know, maybe he's dancing around a bit, but we'll see. So 2016, not long after, Mark Hunt files a lawsuit in the district court in Nevada before it's U.S. District Court, federal court before Judge Jennifer Dorsey. The amended complaint comes out in June of 2017. And basically, he's alleging a ton of claims that includes breach of contract. It includes battery. It includes fraud. It includes breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, unjust enrichment, and a couple others. So this case is deliberated for a little bit. The UFC moves for a motion to dismiss, as do the other defendants. The named defendants are the UFC, its president Dana White, and the culprit here, which is Brock Lesnar. So those are the three defendants. And UFC's name is Zuffa. They just do business as UFC. So Mark Hunt did not succeed at the district court level. A few years later, in 2019, the district court for the District of Nevada dismissed the majority of Hunt's claims, really only leaving one claim left, which was the alleged breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. But that claim didn't even succeed either, which it later failed on a summary judgment motion. The reason why people really cling to this story when I first put it up is because everyone thought this lawsuit was gone. You know, the motion to dismiss was granted. This case doesn't exist. It's off the books. But in American law, we have the ability to appeal a court's decision. So that's exactly what Mark Hunt did. And it turns out that he was successful on two of his claims. So we're in the Ninth Circuit. This is all in the Southwest region. So we're in Nevada and around there, which is the Ninth Circuit. So the Ninth Circuit reversed the district court's dismissal of two of his claims. And that's the fraud claim and the battery claim. And that's where it gets really interesting. Talking about the battery claim, a battery is basically an unwanted touching that's offensive. We're talking about civil battery. This is not criminal.
Jason, he's suing for battery. There's probably two common tweets that Dan has throughout his thread, and it's assault and assumption of the risk. When you talk about sports. Assumption of the risk is one of those things that when you compete in any sport, really, when you are competing on the field, the way you conduct yourself, you are assuming the risks of injury in that sport. Now, those risks are going to be elevated when you play in a sport like UFC, boxing, an actual like physical sport where they literally are punching each other in the face.
Watch on the wrestling slander, Mike. You're getting very close. You're getting very close there. I know what you're trying to do. An actual physical sport. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, right. But Brock Lesnar's not used to actually punching people in the face.
So you did it. I'm going to tell Brock you said that. I'm going to tell Paul.
Throwing chairs.
Yeah.
Brock, you too, so, Jason. You're on notice.
The camera work doesn't have to be so shifty in the UFC. So
Mike, what we have with the slander.
So, Jason, tell me the leg that they are standing on here with this battery claim.
So let's get into Dan's favorite tweet. Is it assumption of the risk? So just for a quick background, assumption of the risk for those who haven't seen the 3,000 tweets. Assumption of the risk is basically a principle that says you assume the inherent risks of the activity that you take part in. Let's take football, for example. If you are in 2015, an NFC West wide receiver, and you play against the 49ers, you assume the risk of suffering a major injury at the hands of Patrick Willis. That is an inherent part of the game, and it's something that you can't claim that an injury caused by Patrick Willis on a routine tackle is the basis for a lawsuit, because you assume that risk by playing the game. It's a dangerous game. So now we're in the UFC, arguably a more dangerous game. That's a conversation for another day, with combat fighting, mixed martial arts. And you assume the risks of all the injuries that can occur inside the octagon, from a kick punch, an arm bar, a full Nelson, whatever it may be. However, Mark Hunt's here claiming, hey, I didn't assume the risk of fighting someone on performance-enhancing drugs, where the organization and its president allegedly knew that my opponent was on drugs. I didn't assume that risk.
The UFC has had their struggles with performance-enhancing drugs, hence when they hired USADA to do their doping program in 2015. So wouldn't you have some kind of reasonable assumption that there would be somebody with a performance-enhancing drug?
It's a fair argument, and I'm sure it's one that the UFC has posed, that they have all the measures in place with USADA and the, you know, all this anti-doping implementation that they've put in. But the key difference here and why this makes this case unique is just the factor of knowledge. In those cases in the past where you've had a fighter come out later and he was on drugs, performance-enhancing drugs, you don't see a major lawsuit in those kind of cases because the opponent hasn't claimed that the UFC and its president knew and permitted the behavior. So if someone happens to slip through the cracks, you can't really hold the employer liable, the UFC, because they didn't really know it was happening. So they didn't permit that kind of activity within their octagon. It's just kind of how it happened in, you know, de facto. But here we have a knowledge claim in that Mark Hunt is saying that the UFC blatantly knew and almost encouraged, based on how well they knew Lesnar and knew his activities, to fight Hunt, and that they put him at a real grave risk. And, you know, that's not even a light term to use there. I think that's a legitimate grave risk they put him in.
You're right. And battery is an intentional tort, which is what you're going to there. They had the knowledge and the intent for him to take performance enhancing drugs and fight in this. They're alleging basically that Dana White didn't give a crap that Brock Lesnar was on roids because he was his prize fighter and he wanted the pay-per-views. But I mean, Dana White's been dragged through the mud this whole year, this last couple of years, about fighters not getting paid enough. He's only, you know, pumping up the prize fighters, you know, the Conor McGregors, the Nurmagomedovs. There's that aspect of it, but I'm going to push back. And here's where I agree with District Court Judge Jennifer Dorsey. In her original ruling, I mean, she cited to baseball, where the case that she cited was Avila versus Citrus Community College District. Again, I just mentioned battery's an intentional tort. In baseball, you have pitchers that intentionally hit batters. The difficult part is the intent to cause harm, right? You have the intent to actually hit somebody, but who knows? You can't get into the mind of somebody because they're just going to deny it, that they have the intent to injure, right? That's the aspect of battery. You have the intent to cause harm, right? So inherently, MMA, you are intentionally acting to cause harm to your opponent. So it's difficult to assess whether or not that the intent to use performance-enhancing drugs was to cause harm to Mark Hunt. And again, I go back to my statement before, the fight was it wasn't a serious fight here. So,
I mean, listen, I'm in support of Jason of an article that does really well on our site. Now, do I necessarily agree with the appeal, you know, and the underlying lawsuit. I don't know, like when you step into the octagon with someone, you intend to harm them, whether you're intending to harm them more because you took steroids. Like, I don't really know. People use steroids for any number of reasons. That doesn't have to do with like getting more power. Sometimes it's recovery. Sometimes it's ability to work out harder and get back faster. I don't know. I mean, we'll see what comes of it, right? This is just certainly one level. Hunt did not win his case. The case is kind of like, speaking of Brock Lesnar, this is like the Undertaker sit-up gif. Like the case now is kind of back from the dead, so to speak, but there's no winning and losing right away. What I will say is kind of interesting. You know, you guys are kind of talking about steroids and Mark Hunt didn't, you know, assume the risk of his opponent using steroids. I mean, listen, and Jason, I know your boys with Mark Hunt at this point. He's mentioning you on his Instagram account. Maybe don't tell him that I'm saying this because he'll come after me with swinging giant left hands. But, you know, what are we supposed to relitigate the steroid era in baseball? You know, like, oh, I didn't assume the risk of this, you know, Barry Bonds, Ken Griffey Jr., Mark McGwire, those guys potentially, maybe not Ken Griffey Jr., I'll leave him out. But
lay off the slander of the kid. Ken Griffey was not mentioned in the Mitch report.
He was not. I just meant like that era of baseball players. You know, don't listen. I know who's friends with Ken Griffey Jr. Please don't tell me. I didn't mean that. Sammy Sosa. Okay. And Barry Bonds, that crew of guys like using steroids and hitting bombs off me. Like, okay, is that supposed to be some type of fraud lawsuit because baseball players were using steroids or are the hitters using steroids? But anyway, Mike, I know you have some comments on fraud. You should. I'm sure Jason has some thoughts on it too. But just at a steroid level, like we've seen this play out in sports, doesn't result in litigation. It's fairly new. Jason, I see you. You have your hand up, ready for a question or an answer.
Yeah, just to rebut that for a second. I mean, I understand you're talking about a civil claim in terms of you know, the home run era of steroids, but we're talking about fighting someone to the death in a cage versus a home run. I mean, can we have some perspective here for what Mark Hunt had to go against? He was facing a man. Have you seen the size of his head? Like, you know what we're talking about here?
Who's
this guy head? Is inside a closed.
Mark Hunt's head's pretty
Brock
big.
Brock Lesnar's head.
Mark Hunt's
well, that's just natural, big. Okay? Well, he worked at that.
How about Barry Bonds' head? Where does that rank in the pantheon of heads?
Well, his head wasn't a dangerous weapon.
I need a before and after of Brock Lesnar's head. Just like Barry Bonds.
Barry Bonds' head is probably the biggest of the three. Let's
I've never seen a head bigger than Barry Bonds.
If you can show me him lunging at a pitcher with the intent of harming, then I'll respect the size of his head.
So I can tell you emphatically, Barry Bonds has not done a Zinedine Zidane headbutt on any of his players he went up against. That would be assault.
I mean, we can go back and forth. I think it's whatever. It's we're going to have to see. The case has been revived in the battery case, but what we have still standing too is this fraud. I mean, you mentioned Dana White's, you know, statement that Brock Lesnar is going to be the most tested. You know, we're going to make sure that everything's safe. I mean, they were also doing at the time because USADA was new within like the last year. They were really trying to crack down on performance enhancing drugs and grow the brand. And so, Jason, dive a little bit more into the fraud claim.
The Ninth Circuit, they discuss whether White's statement was a false representation of material fact or whether it could be. But just to play pretty literally here, like Dan did earlier with the quote, White allegedly said that Lesnar will be the most tested athlete on this card. Well, that doesn't really say that he will take action if the tests come back positive. So just to play on the statement again, if we want to be really literal here, but
to be fair, in Dana White's defense here, Lesnar had joined back with UFC and he was in that USADA doping program like I think a month or two before the fight, and he had been tested I don't know how many times, but they, you know, so the reports go that he had been tested several times leading up to the fight, and it was just this one that was 11 days prior to the fight that wasn't expedited that did come back positive. The other ones that he was tested were all negative. So to Dana White's credit here, just a little bit, you know, he was tested before multiple times before the fight that did come back negative. It was just this one where he tested positive for clomiphene. So what more does a misrepresentation of fact can they pick apart from Dana White?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly an interesting and a fair point. But, you know, Hunt's here saying that he didn't do enough and that he claimed emphatically that he was the most tested and that he wasn't on anything and that it was going to be a fair fight. And Hunt claims that he knew the exact opposite was true. You know, no matter what happened in the past tests or what he made it out to seem to the public, Hunt says that that was all a facade and that he really knew the true state of Lesnar's, you know, medication and what he was doing. So just to get into what the district court did in terms of fraud, what's interesting here is that the main discussion is not really about whether fraud took place. It's really just about whether we can kind of discern what damages would look like. A big problem for courts often is that, yeah, there may have been been an injury, but maybe your best redression is not through damages. Maybe it's through some kind of injunction or getting someone to stop doing something, which here is not really possible. So the district court says that while there could be fraud, we're not really looking too deeply into it. The damages here are just totally not something that we can calculate. I mean, you're asking us to consider, had you fought Lesnar and he was not on performance-enhancing drugs, you're asking us to believe that you would have won. How can we possibly assume that and award you damages, just assuming that you would have beat him if he was clean? I know you said, you know, this fight was a long time ago. I'm trying to remember. It was kind of a dud. You know, Lesnar did win unanimously, but the court's not willing to just accept the assumption that Hunt would have won had he not taken any performance enhancing drugs, Lesnar, that is. With that said, the Ninth Circuit got pretty creative. Credit to Hunt and his lawyers, because they were the ones who posed this argument. They said, don't worry about wins and losses. This is not what you need to consider in terms of calculating damages. There's a third option here, and this is actually the reality. Mark Hunt, had he known that Brock Lesnar was on performance-enhancing drugs, would not have fought in UFC 200. So that's withdrawal. It's that simple. You don't worry about whether he won or lost. He wouldn't have fought. So with that, you may ask, how do damages come out of that? If he wouldn't have fought, what are the damages there? And the court says that, you know, he suffered some reputational damages. He suffered some other losses from the UFC 200 taking place that he wouldn't have had he not fought in this and had he dropped out. So with that, damages become a bit easier to discern according to the court. And the theory of damages is far more susceptible to proof.
I think the Ninth Circuit did a good job. And like I said, Hunt's attorney sued, because that definitely is more plausible, because he can actually speak to what he would have or would have not have done. It's less, like you just said, it's less easy to discern whether or not he would have beaten Lesnar had he not been on steroids. So all in all, Jason, absolutely incredible article, incredible timing. Great job breaking this story. Obviously, everyone keep following Jason_Morin on Twitter, and keep following Conduct Detrimental at @ConDetrimental and our website, conductdetrimental.com, for more updates. We'll see when it gets remanded back to the district court how they rule on these two battery and fraud cases. So Dan's favorite segment now, as we wrap up this episode, this Conduct Detrimental short, what to watch for. Dan, I know you have a good one.
I spoiled it a little bit. I was messing around on Netflix over the weekend. I saw this thing. It was recommended 99% to me. This thing called Screwball. Baseball in the background. I'm like, let me check this out. I don't know what this is. So I watched the trailer. It's the story of A-Rod's run-in with Major League Baseball. When Rob Manfred at the time was not Major League Baseball commissioner. He was number two in command, soon to be Major League commissioner. And there was kind of I'll call it a witch hunt, but this coordinated effort to get A-Rod suspended from Major League Baseball, make him the fall guy for all the steroid error. So I didn't know the story. It's a crazy story. Long and short, the whole Biogenesis lab, the whole Manny Ramirez getting taken down with steroids and A-Rod getting taken down with steroids, it all relates to this one guy who was kind of hanging around like the tanning salons. So one really low-level employee at a tanning salon ends up taking down A-Rod, Manny Ramirez, among a number of Major League Baseball superstars. It's a crazy story, but there was a period of time not so long ago where A-Rod was almost permanently suspended from baseball and banned from the Hall of Fame, as, you know, kind of indirectly or unofficially some of our other guys, be it Bonds or McGuire or Clemens, those guys are. But A-Rod is very close there. I don't know if we view A-Rod in that sense anymore. A-Rod seems to have escaped the stink of the steroid era. Now he's on Major League Baseball tonight. He's, you know, had the A-Rod Corp. He's owned an NBA team. Fascinating, hilarious in some portions, but it's the story of Biogenesis and Major League Baseball steroid era, really in the 2000s, not so long ago. But yeah, so my what to watch for is Screwball on Netflix. Fantastic. I didn't even know what I was getting into, and everyone I've recommended it to since seems to be on board that it is great. It's definitely at the intersection of sports law. Screwball on Netflix, definitely check it out.
And I just got to say, as we track the Mark Hunt case, one thing that I'm watching for is Mark Hunt is famous for something. First of all, when he knocks someone out, he tends to walk away very just politely from his opponent who may be face down on the mat. But what he also does is the famous shoey, where he takes a shoe, pours a beer in the shoe, and then he just downs it. So we're going to watch the district court. And if we get a win, Mark Hunt, I'm calling you out. We need a shoey immediately after the win.
Question, is the shoey created by Danny Ricciardo in Formula One? Is that who created the shoey?
I think it long preceded him. I don't think he is old enough to create the shoey.
That was the first person I've ever heard of doing a shoey. So there are other human beings on this earth that take their shoe off, pour a beer in it, and drink it. There are other people that do that.
I think every rugby team in America probably does that as well. Yeah.
I'm embarrassed that I said that. Listen, I gotta be roasted for not knowing who originated the shoe. I thought it was in Drive to Survive with my boy Danny Rick, but I guess not.
My what to watch for is pretty short and sweet. Baseball playoffs around the corner. There is a 30% chance as of tonight, which is September 28th. There's a 30% chance that in the American League, the wild card will end in a three-way tie with Toronto, Boston, and New York. Yankees.
Wow.
I'm interested to see how this wraps up. Yankees are playing Toronto tonight, tomorrow, and the next day. And then they have a three-game series against Tampa, who's not going to care because they're already they haven't clinched yet, but they're already in. So interesting to see how the wild card race plays out. You also have the Seattle Mariners and the Oakland A's kind of trailing right behind them too. So five teams kind of right at the top there. Interested to see what happens.
Legal life advice. So I spoke to Pace Law School tonight. That's Elizabeth Howard Law School, where I'm from in Westchester County, New York. Interesting question from the crowd. And I know a lot of people listening to this are going to have the same type of question. So I figured we'd address it here. Someone asked me, I think they were 2L, and they said, how do you become a sports agent? So obviously I'm not a sports agent. And, you know, I was briefly on the sports agent side. That's something I wanted to do for my career. I ended up getting a taste of it and I didn't really love it. In order to really be a successful sports agent, sounds really fun. There are a lot of people that want to be a sports agent. In order to be a successful sports agent, you need clients. And in order to get clients, you need to, at some level, I imagine, have played the sport that you want to be an agent in. You don't have to, but it'll certainly help. Speaking a second language, so in baseball, speaking Spanish is incredibly, incredibly helpful. But number three, it's also having some direct tie-in. You don't, let's say you didn't play, you don't speak Spanish, but you're Drew Rosenhaus and you went to Miami with all of those, you know, Ray Lewis and Warren Sapp. He had a direct into those guys. So a lot of the world in agency is going to be based on commission, right? You don't really necessarily get a base salary. It's what you can get in commission. So unless you have some real tie-in to the sport, just being a fan is not usually enough to convince people to sign with you. You need to have some true and tried background. What I did say, which is a little different that we haven't had in 100 years of pro sports and trying to be an agent, this NIL era, and Mike, you know this well, we had Trent Robeson on the podcast last week. Trent Robeson's a junior at Miami, and Trent is already getting deals for athletes, college-level athletes. So if you have aspirations of being an athlete and you're a college student listening to this, or you're a law student, there's nothing stopping you right now from reaching out to college-level athletes and saying, hey, maybe I can try to find you some deals on the NIL level. You have guys that are now closer to your age as a student, and maybe they're your contemporaries. Maybe they want someone to sign up like you. So my advice to the student that asked me at Pace, I said, you know, I've heard of a handful of people, law students, reaching out to these athletes and saying, hey, I'll help you. I'll get whatever. If I can get you a deal, maybe I can get some type of commission. I think that's an interesting path. I think if you're sitting here and you're sitting on your computer, why not reach out to athletes? Why not try to help? I told you, and you guys know on the podcast, I've spoke to a couple D1 programs. A lot of these athletes are 18, 19 years old, and they're looking for kind of guidance on this. Sure, they can get it from school and people like myself, but why not reach out to them? I don't think there's any downside in doing it. Worst case, like I always tell schools I speak to, reach out to as many people as you can. Worst case, they don't respond. And so anyway, that's my advice. If you want to be an agent, the NILR, you can start much, much sooner and start with a class of people that are much closer to your age than they ever really were before.
Similar to my legal life advice, you know, on the last episode with Trent Robeson, I mean, the time is now. First up, you're listening to this podcast, you're following Conduct Detrimental, but keep connecting with people on Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram, just grow your network.
And I would just add, never be afraid to message someone. You just never know what comes out of it. People are way more susceptible to responding than you probably would have thought they are. So just send a message, introduce yourself, and you never know where that conversation will take you. It's done a lot for me, just reaching out cold or reaching out to ask a question about something or showing your work. So don't be afraid to reach out, get a conversation started.
Some law school legal advice. Make sure to check out Themis. Themis is the sponsor of this podcast. Again, we have a special link on their website, themisbar.com/condetrimental. Check them out, see what they have to offer. Again, if there's tables at your law school with the Themis rep there, go give them a chat. Maybe say, hey, you know, I heard about you on Conduct Detrimental. So for all of us, this has been another Conduct Detrimental short. Make sure to follow conductdetrimental.com and stay up to date on the Mark Hunt lawsuit. And if you want to write, email us, condetrimental@gmail.com. Jason mans the fort with our emails and he's very responsive. And if you want to submit anything for our article. So Jason, again, at Twitter, @Jason_Morin, myself, Mike_Son_Law. Dan is at Sports Law Lust, the show @ConDetrimental. So that will end another episode of Conduct Detrimental Shorts.